Okay, last talk. I'll try and move relatively quickly so we can move on. I'm going to talk a little bit about some genomic resequencing of a bulk segregant heat-tolerant susceptible broccoli population that basically this is sort of a culmination of work I've been undertaking for most of my career. We've come to the point in the last few years where we're really looking closely at material that we believe we've successfully moved into a heat-tolerant type of broccoli. So if you know anything about broccoli, if you're my age, you probably hardly remember broccoli as a kid, and simply because it wasn't much available and we didn't eat a lot. Probably in the 60s, we barely ate about a pound, and interestingly, it's about the same amount of sweet potatoes that we eat now. We're eating up to about 9 pounds of broccoli per person per year. And there's probably no vegetable that's seen this kind of increase in the U.S. It's definitely a success story in terms of, think about, you know, eating good, healthy vegetables. This is one where there's a lot of benefits that we consumers accrue by eating it, and we've certainly got it to the point where people are consuming it on a wide, much bigger scale than they used to. California produces about 85-90%. Actually, if you include the Yuma area as sort of part of that complex, they would fall into about 85-90% of the production. And they are able to supply the heads year-round, not really by producing in any one area, but by shifting production. So in the sun, the only areas where you could actually produce it year-round would be in the Salinas Valley or the Santa Maria Valley. Otherwise, those are primarily the summer-producing areas, and then they move to the Central Valley in the spring and the fall, and then in the winter everything goes down to El Centro and to Yuma. So they've created quite a good distribution system, and a lot of suppliers can produce a year-round product. Interestingly, broccoli was introduced onto the East Coast and probably was first widely grown in the U.S. In the East, brought probably by Italian gardeners around the turn of the 1900. But somewhere in about the middle of the 20th century, it was found to be very well adapted to sort of more Mediterranean-like climates in California. And so then production really shifted there in a big way. So year-round production in the East may be limited most by the possibility of heat damage during midsummer. Obviously, we have a problem in the winter also, but theoretically, we have proposed for several years that you could establish a similar sort of shifting production from northern Maine in the summer, where there's actually substantial production, into northern Florida in the winter, where there also is already significant production going on. So if the high temperatures is a key factor limiting where and when broccoli can be grown, typical responses that you'll see, and this is where we're talking if temperatures remain above 25 to 30 degrees C, you'll see bracts in the head, distorted shapes, and discoloration. Uneven bead size is a real big one. But it's also possible that broccoli will fail to head at high temperatures. So some broccolis have a vernalization requirement, but it's not like you think about for cabbage or collard greens or something like that, where it's got to go down to, much 5 to 10 degrees centigrade. It's actually somewhere in the neighborhood about 22 centigrade. So if you don't go below 22 to 20, you actually may not have heading occurring in broccoli. So these are some typical responses where you see almost something cauliflower-like. And these pictures are all taken. All of our heat-tolerance studies are done in the summer in South Carolina. So we transplant in late May, and we're harvesting through middle to late July. So it's very hot conditions in general, not considered a very conventional environment for broccoli. But you see these bracts in the head. Here's one where it's trying to form a head, and they got very uneven bead size. And then there's the possibility something like a little flower cluster there, but it's almost not heading. And one of the things that we observe is because you you don't get good apical development of that head. There's probably a loss of apical dominance, and typically you'll get a lot of lateral growth on things that normally would not do that. So over the past 25 years, we've been working trying to select for Heath Tomlinson broccoli, and these are pictures taken from a variety of lines that, in the middle of July in South Carolina, and we believe we've attained significant tolerance to non-conventional high-temperature conditions. So what we've been trying to do over the last few years is really piece together what this is all about. We've assumed for a long time that we're dealing with a quantitative trait. We've made slow progress, sort of plodding along, and it's taken a while to concentrate all those positive alleles into single individual genotypes. So we've assumed at the outset that we're dealing with a quantitative trait. We've made some strategic crosses of our lines to try and look at how many kind of factors we might be dealing with. And I'm going to talk today about one population in particular where we're interested in identifying QTLs for tolerance, and we want to look at for markers tightly linked to the heat tolerance QTLs, and then explore the potential candidate genes using a publicly available Abrascola genome now that's we have access to. So this is we've done some crosses where we've looked at tolerant by non-tolerant, and this was a cross that we made that which is more like two parents that had some level of tolerance, and we also know they are unrelated. So so we expected in this population to actually see better levels of tolerance than when we're looking at a tolerant by susceptible, where we get a really wide range in segregation. So this is relatively small. This is a double hap. We've also done a lot of this work in double haploid populations. It's a tool we have in Brassicola acea. This is a small population, though. We only had 83 double haploid lines. We initially screened this population during two different summers, and then we looked for 20 lines from the extremes, 10 on the positive end and 10 on the negative end, that were reevaluated in two subsequent summers. And then we used a whole genome resequencing with 150 nucleotide paired end reads. We conducted on both parents, and this is a little bit like a bulk surrogate analysis where we've taken a pool of the most tolerant and then a pool of the most susceptible. I'm comparing them versus doing a genotype by sequencing approach, which we've used with some other larger populations. So the raw reads were aligned to Brassicola genome SNPs called and a delta index calculated using the QTL-seq pipeline, and then we did functional annotation with QTL regions using ANOVAR, and the genes with missense or nonsense mutations were considered candidate possible genes. So this gives you what we've used. We developed a 9-point scale, which is subjective and it's difficult, but we definitely see a lot of variation. So you go from this fairly extreme, that's important. It actually still made some kind of a flower cluster or a head. So it's not a vernalizing requirement on this line. So you've got a very poor, it's almost cauliflower-like, and you see this gradation to something which is actually relatively good. It's much more like broccoli. It's more dense, got uniform bead size and green. And all these would have been taken off lines in those summer conditions. So this gives you just a histogram of the initial population. Then we took the extremes on the low end and the high. Now, we're careful now. We didn't want to get into the mid-range, so we have a limited number to choose from. And then after growing that population out, then we had these 20 lines. And then among those 20, we selected the five poorest and then the five best that we did this bulk resequencing on. So this gives you an idea. So there's the five best lines. They're actually relatively similar in appearance. And one thing about the poor ones, there is somewhat different things going on here, and that may be a complexity in terms of the analysis. But clearly they're much poorer in general than our five best. And then, so in terms of results, we screened that 83 double haploid population. He had, it wasn't perfect, but we had a continuous variation among those lines. I wouldn't necessarily say it was highly normal due to the small population size. So the range was 1.1, which is, that one of those very ugly little things, to an 8.6, which is almost the top score. And then 22 lines, actually of the 83, did not form heads at all. So there probably were some in there that required vernalization. And then five lines were chosen from each bulk. So the average of those five, they had a score of 7, and the poorest ones had a score of 2.6. And we decided not to go with more than five because then we were skewing those numbers closer to one another. And so we stuck with a relatively small sample size. Sequencing produced more than 750 million high-quality reads with generated 650,000 SNPs. So that's really looking at the difference between the two parents that we started with. And then two significant QTLs were detected, one on chromosome 6 with a 480 kilobase interval, and then one on chromosome 9 with a 1.2 little bigger interval here. And so this just gives you a little bit of a visualization. So our analysis in terms of the QTL on chromosome 6, and one of these QTLs came from one parent and the other came from the other, so that's why you have if you look at the numbers, there's one's a negative and one's a positive, so they're coming from the different parents. 12 non-synonymous polymorphisms in a dual domain containing gene found in the region. It's a DNAJ proteins that can protect cellular membranes and prevent protein folding during heat stress. It's a possible candidate gene that we might look at for probably more fine-tuning these QTLs now into markers that we could use. And then this one is a little more interesting. Three FLR genes fall within the range collated with this region, and FRI proteins are required for upregulation of FLC, which is an important flowering locus. So some of these certainly intrinsically look like possible candidates that we might exploit to develop markers. Now that we've now identified a total of, with a previous published work, we've previously identified five QTLs, so now we're up to 7 in the material that we have, and we're now making strategic crosses where we hope to have all of these segregating at one time. And again, this all emphasizes the inheritance of tolerance is complex, and we've got factors on chromosome 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, and 9. With one on each except chromosome 9, which is has two. And there we also in the previous work identified an epistatic effect. So that's a little more difficult to deal with because difficult to select for that individually. And again, the candidate genes for this study included DNAJ coding genes and FRL genes, and we hope to use these to create a better markers for usage. So this is part of this work is funded by my own project with the Agricultural Research Service, but we also had significant funding from a Specialty Crop Research Initiative grant. And that's me in the middle of July in South Carolina, which 25 years ago probably never seemed possible. But and we generally, I would not recommend to grow in this environment. But what we're really hoping is that we have material that can sustain temperature spikes and a somewhat warmer environment than you might normally push this crop into. How am I doing for time? Any questions? You want to use the mic?
The issue has been about the threshold used to declare the QTL, the threshold.
What about?
The standard that is used to declare the QTL.
Oh,
Yeah, I'm probably not. Obviously, the my postdoc is much better versed in the actual analysis, Sandra Branham. But I'm pretty sure we use a pretty standard LOD score. I could probably better answer that question by giving you my card and having you contact us separately if you want to, or